The hour of 10:40 having arrived, we'll call the House PACS Committee to order. We have a quorum, so we are officially called to order. Representative Schultz, we can't move the minutes. She's not here. Okay, she's excused.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Before we begin, we have a new House researcher on the DFL side. Travis Reese, right here, who is replacing Molly Richardson, who is on maternity leave. So,
we have on the
No news.
Any news yet?
No news. But, anyway, I just wanted to introduce.
To know when there's
news. Okay. I prefer me first.
Thank you.
Please call me before her husband gets the message. Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Reese, welcome to the PACS Committee. And just remember, it's not a committee. It's an adventure. Okay, with that, we have Chair Anderson. Chair Anderson asks members 1086. Okay, Chair Anderson asks moves House File 1086. Chair Anderson, is the A1 amendment yours?
It is, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Chair Anderson moves the H1086A1 amendment. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill before us as amended. Chair Anderson asks to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment was technical in nature by Ms. Nancy, so we are should be good to go on that. Members, you're very familiar with this issue. We talk about this every year. What we are doing with this bill is that we are doing one of the tax conformity extenders that we've done in the past. Part of this bill includes the mortgage debt cancellation tax relief tax extender to form conform with the federal level. The feds haven't quite enacted it yet, but we have this bill in place in order to make that happen if it were, as well as the mortgage insurance premium deductibility piece. So that's what the bill does in a nutshell. I have Mr. Egger here as a resource if necessary, but I know that your time is crunched today too.
Okay, thank you very much, Chair Anderson S. We have Mr. Eggers as a resource. Is there anyone else in the audience who's testifying on behalf of the bill with concerns on the bill? Does the department wish to testify? Okay, with that, questions for members to the bill? Okay, seeing none,
Representative Dabney.
Chair
Dabney. I'm sorry. We're on House File 1086.
Correct. As amended. Correct.
Chair, either the author or the testifier, does this interact with President Trump's, I think the first thing he did in office, which was cancel a mortgage insurance reduction that's going to cost the average mortgage owner about $900 a year, I think, in higher mortgage insurance rates? Is that what this is allowing people to deduct? Can you help me with that?
Mr. Eggers, please state your name and who represent for the record, and then to Chair Dabney's question.
Mr. Chair, my name is Paul Egger, Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. Representative Dabney, you're referencing the decision, so kind of in the last month or so of President Obama's administration, there was a reduction in the FHA mortgage insurance premiums, which was subsequently reversed by President Trump once he took office. This bill would apply, the provision in this bill related to mortgage insurance premiums would apply more broadly than the specific issue with the FHA premiums. So anybody who has that's paying mortgage insurance either for an FHA loan, a VA loan, or through private, through the conventional loan, if they meet the income guidelines that are part of the federal tax extenders, which, again, if those are enacted in the future, this would prospectively conform, they would be able to take this particular deduction on their state taxes. The provision you're talking about is a concern. I don't know the exact dollar amount, if it was $800 or $900 or $500 or $600. I'm trying to recall articles that I had seen, but you're correct. That is going to be a provision that is going to result in buyers that are paying private mortgage insurance paying additional if they're in the have to get mortgage insurance.
Chair Dabney.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Eggers. Yeah, according to your national organization, I think it's going to affect 700,000 to 800,000 households, or eight to 900,000
Mr. Chair, and Representative Dabney, yeah, that sounds familiar. I'd bring that information with me, but yeah, that is a concern that our national association is continuing to work on with HUD and other groups that are interested in this particular.
And Mr. Chair, just one last follow-up. Thank you. And am I correct? My understanding from mortgages I've purchased, once you pay it and once you pay down the mortgage to a certain level, historically the mortgage insurance then went away. And under the President Trump's decision, if you have to have the mortgage insurance, you have it for the life of the mortgage now. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, I'm not certain on that provision. I would have to do some research and get back to you on that.
And Mr. Okay. Eggert, that is kind of an important question, so if you could maybe let the committee members know on sure. that. Chair Dabney?
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Mr. Eggert, thank you. It got a whole lot more expensive to own a home on January 20th. Thank you.
Questions for members on the bill before us as amended? Chair Anderson, as for news for motion that House File 1086 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Chair Anderson S. and Mr. Eggers. Okay, we're going to be a little bit flexible here on bills. We're going to move them around a little bit. I will now move House File 1235, Accretia Bill.
Chair Carl, what happened to the Pearson bill? When you started the meeting, you were sitting at the table. Did that get laid over? Or what transpired?
No. It's on our list. We will talk about
it. I saw him at the table, and he was listed first, so I was wondering what...
And I'm trying to accommodate members' schedules best I can. So we're going to go Precia, Pearson, Kaczynski, Pearson, right? We want to hit members first that are not on the committee, and members as a rule. Okay, because people have to be places. Okay, House File 1235, I will move that. I see no amendments. Representative Precia to the Precia Davis bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and to respect the committee's time, and I appreciate it. I have 10 bills this week, so it's a little bit of a rush, but I just want to present this bill. This is a $60 million tax credit bill for rural growth funds administered by the Department of Deed with $40 million in additional investments, so it can yield up to $100 million. Essentially, what this bill does, we had this conversation last session, we're bringing it back up, this incentivizes rural investment. Those of us that are in the rural communities know one of the biggest challenges we have is moving capital and having access to capital. Oftentimes, going to the local bank, you try, but it can be very difficult to get access to some of those capital, especially if you have a more risky endeavor like a shrimp farm that we're seeing in southern Minnesota or in my area or other entrepreneurs. So this is our best attempt to move some of that investment powerlessness down in the metro area out to the communities where we have great ideas in rural Minnesota as well.
Okay, anyone wish to testify on behalf of the bill with concerns? The department and members, I'm calling for the department. I think they have other commitments, but they do have some testimony on in writing on, I think it's House File 1499. So, but I always, for the record, want to have people understand the department is welcome to testify anytime. So, with that, questions for members? Chair Carlson.
Just a quick one, Representative Precia. Is there a definition of what rural is?
I believe it's.
Thank you, in the bill, I'm looking at it kind of quickly here. I didn't see it.
Right. And in the bill, there is an exclusion of, I believe it's the 7-county metro area. I believe that's the case. I'm going to look over to my test card.
Towns under 50,000.
Thank you. Towns under 50,000 is the exclusion.
Chair Carl. Okay.
That's what I was interested in. Thank you.
Any other questions? Chair, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Precia. I appreciate that you have some targeting in this, but as we all know, there are areas of our state, both rural and or greater Minnesota and metro, that have really high unemployment and other areas that are doing really well. In the metropolitan area, the exurbs are doing really well, but there's definitely inner ring suburbs and parts of the inner city that aren't. And the same is true of rural. And I'm wondering if you've looked at some data and considered targeting it even further to areas of high unemployment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Duffer. We have looked at that, and we are open to some conversations on that. One of the things, and this question has come up, I understand as a state there are pockets of pressure points. Let me offer this. As a rural legislator, I'm responding to what I hear in my backyards. I'm responding to what I travel, and that's why I put this together. I'm more than happy to help in other areas and other bills that would come up, but this is a specific practice to help the people that I'm hearing from the most.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, and that's appropriate for you as an author, Representative Crescia, to focus on your area, but I hope that we as a committee will look broadly at all the needs and how to best target economic growth in areas that need it.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Questions for members? Okay, with that, do you want to wrap it up there, Representative Crescia?
I would just say thank you, members. I'd love to have your support.
I will renew my motion that House File 1235 be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Crescia.
Thank you, members.
Item next, the gentleman from Lyon. House File 1354. I will move House File 1354. But before we get started with the gentleman from Lyon, I would ask, does anyone wish to testify on behalf of the bill with concerns? And again, the department can address the committee at any time. To your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to bring 1354 before the committee. It simply, House File 1564 moves the depreciation from 5 years to 10 years in the areas of bonus depreciation and Section 179 deductions. Under current law, the state of Minnesota, if you can deduct 20% right away and then move the rest of the 80% over the next 5 years. If you do not have the income to offset that, say you made only 8% more and you were able to use 8% of that remaining 8% of that 16 over the next 5 years would be lost. And so this bill essentially allows you to carry that potential 8% to 16% or someplace in between into the years up to 10 years. This allows for more if you have a bad year to take advantage of those investments that you've made.
Okay. Questions
to
House File 1354. Okay, with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1354 be there included in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now, the premier bill of the day, Representative Pearson. Okay, Representative Pearson, I will move House File 608. Is there anyone who wishes to speak on behalf of the bill? Okay, we have some folks coming down. Anyone wish to testify with concerns on the bill? And the department will be allowed to provide testimony anytime they'd like. Okay, so with that, the two-year bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. The House File 608 is dealing with basically, you know, one of the biggest barriers to entry into agriculture or farming in the state of Minnesota, whether it's urban or rural, is the collateral, the investment upfront costs of the assets that it usually requires. So this bill addresses that. We're providing some tax credits to make beginning farmers more competitive in the open market. And today I have a couple testifiers to state how it would impact their practice of agricultural interests.
Okay, and I see that we've got a letter from the National Young Farmers Coalition. You know, we look around this place as to who's supporting things or opposing them. Anytime you get Farm Bureau Farmers Union on the same page, that's quite an accomplishment. Then Central Minnesota Young Farmers, Duluth Young Farmers Land Stewardship Project, and the Minnesota Catholic Conference. So we're bringing the Pope in here, too. That's, I don't know how you...
I was going to intro with, now the moment you've all been waiting for, so...
Yes, okay. So, to your testifiers, please state your name and who represents the record, please, sir.
My name is Eric Sanderman from Central Minnesota Young Farmers Coalition.
Good morning. My name is Matthew Fitzgerald with the Central Minnesota Young Farmers Coalition.
Okay, please provide your testimony, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, representatives, and staff of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify about House File 608, which is a tax credit for young and beginning farmers. Like I said, my name is Eric Sanderud. I farm hops in Benton County, like the thing in beer, and I'm one of the founding members of the Central Minnesota Young Farmers Coalition. I'll speak briefly today about our coalition and why we support this bill, and after my brief comments, Matthew will follow up with a story of his own. The Central Minnesota Young Farmers Coalition formed in 2016 as a membership organization of solely young and beginning farmers. Our members' homes range from Hoffman to St. Cloud, Litchfield and Hutchinson down to Faribault. We have a sister chapter of Young Farmers in Duluth, Minnesota. We are a group that includes members of the Farm Union and the Farm Bureau, organic vegetable growers, conventional row crop growers, and weird stuff in between, like me. The future of farming is uncertain in Minnesota. In fact, it's a well-known fact that the average age of a farmer in the United States is nearing 60. I think by the next release of statistics from the USDA will hit 59. So in order to continue the strong tradition of farming, both culturally and economically across Minnesota, we need to bring the new generation in. And for that new generation, the number one barrier is access to land. Our desire to farm is directly at odds with the high cost of entry. House Bill 608 addresses that challenge. It's a practical and a big tent solution that creates a win-win for the future of farming in three major ways. First, by using a tax credit, this bill creates a tangible benefit, not just to the young farmers who end up with the land, but to the owners of those ag assets who provide those opportunities to farm to that beginning farmer through sale or rental. Secondly, this bill is broad enough to support all of Minnesota's farmers. Crop or cattle, conventional or alternative, large or small. As nearly less than 1% of the U.S. population, we as farmers cannot divide ourselves, but instead work for solutions that benefit each and every one of us, like this bill. And finally, the tax credit gives financial management training to young farmers so that we can ensure that the energy and passion that the young farmers are bringing is matched with applicable management tools and to become a strong, reliable business in our communities. And I'll use it, pass it over to Matthew.
Thank you. Please state your name and who represents the record again.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, representatives. My name is Matthew Fitzgerald. I farm in McLeod County with my family. I'm also one of the founding members of the Central Minnesota Young Farmers Coalition. I grew up on a farm in McLeod County where my family raises about 1,200 acres of corn and soybeans. We raise that organically. After graduating from college, I had the opportunity to work for two great Minnesota companies, Thrivent Financial and Cargill Incorporated. Despite those engaging opportunities and a bright future and career, I found myself pulled back to farming. I desire the opportunity to start my own business. I want to live in a community where I can have an impact and where I can know all my neighbors by their first names. Finally, I'm compelled by the opportunity and the necessary work of raising food for Minnesota. House Bill 608 will help me get a foot in the door in McLeod County, where the average rent for the best ground soared to over $312 an acre in 2014. By providing an incentive to landowners, I will be able to start conversations about transitioning land and have the opportunity to develop long-term relationships to build my own operation. House Bill 608 is not a silver bullet, but we as farmers know how to make a little bit go a long way. If Minnesota is serious about committing to becoming a state with strong agriculture, this is our bill. If legislators want to balance sensible investment with big impact, this is your bill. If we as farmers want to work with everyone, big and small, rural and urban, wrinkled hands and fresh faces, this is our bill. House Bill 608 is practical and a win-win. We as young and beginning farmers from across the state, thank you for your support.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Julie Arnold. I'm a vegetable farmer from Lindstrom, Minnesota, and I also organize with the Land Stewardship Project. LSP is a member organization that works to promote family farms and a sustainable food system. We have over 4,000 member households, a third of them farmers, a third are rural, and a third are urban. Thank you, Representative Pearson, for House File 608, bringing this bill forward, and Chair Davids for a meeting with LSP members last week about this. At LSP, we believe that if we have more farmers on the land, better stewardship of the land follows. Instead of the consolidation of farmland into larger corporate farms, we think we would like to see more farmers on the land. This means supporting young and beginning farmers and getting started. LSP has been involved many years in supporting beginning farmers through our farmer training program, Farm Beginnings. We also wrote and have pushed this bill over the years as we see the average age of the farmer steadily rise, and we're hopeful of its passage this year. I loved growing up in the country, and I pursued farming because of the deep love and connection with the land and the folks who live in it. I want to be able to live and work on the land that I was raised on. As a young farmer, I'm excited to see legislation that supports beginning farmers' access to land because I know that land access is the greatest barrier to new farmers. It's hopeful to focus on legislation that helps beginning farmers get started. We are, after all, the future of food in this country. I want more young farmers to have the opportunity of land access that I do, and if we want a food system and rural Minnesota to be strong and healthy, we need to support young and beginning farmers to provide food for us. The strength of our rural communities depend on it. Thank you.
Thank you. And just to the testifiers, somebody said the average age of a farmer is going to be 60. That's not that old. it's really not. Questions for members? Chair Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. How many young farmers do we have in Minnesota? And what age constitutes a young farmer? So this is a
Danarut?
I grew up on a dairy farm down in Rice County.
Chair Detmer? Mr. Sanderud?
Thank you. There aren't great statistics on the age of farmers, especially state by state. If you read the USDA statistics, the Ag Census is probably our best source. And according to that, these are national numbers, but we lost 100,000 farmers from 2008 to 2013, and we only gained 1,000 farmers under the age of 35. So this bill is not particularly just for young, it is for beginning, which is defined as 10 years or less of experience in the field. So I don't have a good answer for you on how many young farmers there are, but the USDA says under 35 would be what that kind of age break is, and that is what percent? I don't know what the percent of our national farmers off the top of my head. I can find it for you.
Virginia Pearson?
Mr. Chair, you know, someone of your age, 40 or so, would still qualify on this program because it's beginning farmer program, not young farmer necessarily, as the testifier was stating. So you have many years of qualification. You could do this at the age of 90. You could start this if you wanted to. So beginning farmer is what we're addressing, but I appreciate the question because it addresses the significant issue that Minnesota and the entire nation is facing as folks have left the agriculture industry.
Thank you. Chair Detmer.
No, thank you. Thank you.
Chair Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a couple questions for the testifiers. Did any of you grow up in a farming family or have farming experience, or did you just decide I want to be a farmer and get out there?
Let's just start there and go this way.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, I grew up on a family farm. I did not grow up on a family farm. I grew up in Edina, Minnesota, of all places, and ended up in farming.
On a family suburb.
I grew up in Lindstrom, Minnesota, on a hobby farm, my family's hobby farm.
Okay. Sure. Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, I just pulled up some stats here. The average age of a farmer has been cited, and I Googled this. Said in 1978, there were just under 100,000 farms. Now we're down to about 75,000 farms. So what I'm trying to figure out is less land being farmed, or are the farms just getting bigger?
Farms are getting bigger.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, this is what I'm wondering about is in the ag statistics, what's the definition of a farmer? Do you have to own a farm, or can you be like a hired hand? Is that archaic term? I don't know. Hired hand? I don't know.
Okay. Sure. You can enter.
Okay. Well, whatever. Do they count as farmers? Who's a farmer?
Mr. Sanderu, who's a farmer?
Mr. Chair, Representative. The USDA definition is still, I believe, if you could gross a $1,000 or more off of a certain parcel of land that you own makes you a farmer. There was a period of really high corn prices where we saw the number of farms significantly increase in the United States, and that was because people with large acreage lots for their residential home were being included as farms because they could have grown enough crop to gross $1,000 revenue. It's not an excellent statistic, but it's a difficult one to try to change because it's very important.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Chair Lesh, if you look at page 2 of the bill, line 2.3, provides the majority of day-to-day physical labor and management on the farm. So okay. It's a little bit of a different definition.
Okay.
Chair Lesh.
Well, thank you. Well, Mr. Chair, the reason I'm asking this is I've heard multiple of the testifiers say the biggest, I guess, barrier to farming is access to land. And I actually looked at this a few years ago when I tried to 1031 exchange some property that I had from a business and found out how expensive ag land was and decided I wasn't going to be buying any ag land because I couldn't buy any that was worth, it was going to be worthwhile to rent out or something. But as has been said, land's the one thing they're not making any more of. And if you've got fewer farms growing fewer farmers getting bigger farms, I found myself asking this question, Mr. Chair, when we were talking about the inheritance tax. And one of the biggest reasons for increasing the limit on the inheritance tax was that these family farmers don't want to have to liquidate or parcel off their lands to pay the taxes that would be due on those lands. And yet, that is the one thing that's allowing these farms, or fewer and fewer farmers, to grow bigger and bigger and bigger with less access to people who want entry into the market. And we didn't bring that up at the time, but I found myself wondering how much our decisions on raising the cap on inheritance taxes allows the fewer and fewer wealthier farmers to aggregate more and more land, thereby driving prices up and prohibiting access to folks who aspire to be farmers. Now, I'm not suggesting that people who grew up in a family farm, you know, shouldn't be farming. And that's one of the best training mechanisms to be a successful farmer is if you grew up in a farm family. But some of these folks who want into the market, I mean, I think, Mr. Chair, these are some of our best resources to make new farmers, because most of us who didn't grow up on farms still have that Norman Rockwell idea of what a farm is. How cool is that? You know, until we have to wake up at, you know, 4:30 or something, and then it's not really that cool anymore. But I think we want to encourage that, Mr. Chair, and I just wonder how much the suggestion is that we can give tax breaks and spend more taxpayer dollars on this, which may be worthwhile. But I wonder how much some of the other decisions we make in this committee have in terms of access for some of these people into farming. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. Questions from members? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I can speak for one of those that grew up on a farm for quite a bit of my life, still own a farm and rent it out. And one of the challenges we have with land prices is that, yes, farmers are getting larger as far as the number of acres that they are running. Sometimes it's rented farmland too, but the amount of acreage of a farm that qualifies for estate tax and others is becoming smaller and smaller, to the point that 160 acres, which was the average homestead that was given during the time when this was originally a state, now more than qualifies for the estate tax. And so I think that challenge we have is that the land keeps growing up, sometimes artificially because of other market issues that are happening out there, without the benefit to the farmer. And I think that's the challenge that we have, is how do we help with some of the situations that are outside of their control. So I think this is an interesting bill, and I certainly do support it.
Questions for members? Chair Carlson.
Yeah, I'm just curious, what other incentives would help keep people on the farm? And I have cousins in western Wisconsin. They grew up on a dairy farm, and my cousin was quite concerned, she's now passed, that initially none of her children were willing to take over the farm operation, and they had the opportunity. It was a prosperous farm. She used to talk about years ago they had one farm, there were dairies, so pretty soon they had two and then three, but they were all small farms. I don't know what the acreage would have been, but they were continually expanding. But to encourage her children until her youngest son finally decided that he would like to farm and is now farming, but the other four had absolutely no interest. The attraction of the big city, you know, western Wisconsin. So what other incentives might be helpful, because I am sympathetic to keeping people on the farm, but this might be one tool, and I'm just curious what some other tools might be. And I think part of the reason they were, the other four, weren't particularly interested, especially in dairy farming, there's a certain lifestyle that's a little more restrictive, let me put it that way, than if you're doing cash crops. And I don't think any of you indicated dairy farming, if I recall. And an NPR had a program the other day where we're on the threshold, I guess, of a shortage of milk because of the number of dairy farms. And so then that would raise the question, do we need incentives for industry-specific to, in this case, encourage, because there is a pending shortage, more people to either expand their dairy operations or to go into dairy farming. And I'm just curious for some feedback.
Representative Pearson?
Well, I guess I'll let them address it. It's a little outside the scope. I'm happy to work with you, Representative Carlson, on coming up with more ideas. I think this bill is really focused on one of the biggest challenges and one of the biggest barriers. In previous testimony in the Ag Committee, one of the things that we found was, you know, somebody who was bidding and had an accepted offer on a property, the challenges with banking created a challenge so that the extension had to be filed for closing over and over again. And so selling to a beginning farmer has its own obstacles related to it, and that might be something that we could address. But those challenges make it a less competitive offer if a beginning farmer is coming into the market and saying, I'd like to buy this land, and it takes longer for that approval. We're basically looking at a situation where somebody would rather sell to somebody who's established, where they know that that property can be closed on more swiftly, and this type of incentive might make that offer, that bid, more competitive. And whether that's renting land, whether that's buying land, I think that holds true across the board for us with this specific bill.
I understand the purpose of this bill, and I'm not arguing against it. It looks like it could be a step in that direction, but I'm not sure that it's the sole solution, and that was the reason I asked that question. But I'll stop there because you've got a number of bills.
Okay. Thank you. And no, this is one idea. This doesn't solve everything that they're trying to do here. And I would just say that the problem with someone trying to get into farming, it's so capital intensive, it costs so much money, that it begs the question, you know, how do you get there unless mom and dad had the farm or an aunt or an uncle? So because it's so capital intensive, it's really tough. Again, then it begs the question, if you had that kind of money, why would you do it? So it kind of goes in a circle here. Vice Chair McDonald, then we'll have it wrapped up. Vice Chair McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for the man with the great fedora, Mr. Sunderman. What do you have of hops as your crop? Do you sell them to local breweries here in town that perhaps some of us have partaked in?
Mr. Sanderud?
So, Mr. Mayor, thank you. I do also like this hat. I sell my hops to craft breweries primarily in Minnesota right now, and that would be, off the top of my head, Fulton, Bad Weather, Dangerous Man, Indeed, and, yes, Fair State Brewing Cooperative. However, as we expand our operations, we'll be reaching across the state.
Vice Chair McDonald.
Great, thank you for that. And just Representative, great bill. A lot of folks from my district, Delano, Wright County, a lot of farming industry come to visit me and certainly want me to support this, so I sign on the bill. And it's a no-brainer. We need to encourage young farmers and old farmers, like some here, new farmers, to continue the great tradition in Minnesota.
Any other questions? With that, Representative Pearson, I'll wrap it up.
I'll only say I grew up as the youngest of four kids on a family dairy farm in southwestern Minnesota. Having an older brother, I always knew I'd have to choose a different path. I ended up following, you know, the wrong crowd and ended up in the legislature. So I'm asking, pleading that you might avoid this happening to another youth in the state of Minnesota, and they can choose a better career than the legislature. And with that, I appreciate your support in the hearing here, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pearson. It's for the children. Okay, with that, I will renew my motion. House File 608 be laid before possible inclusion of the omnibus tax bill. Thank you to everyone. 10, we will go to 1020. Chair Hamilton, if you could please come forward. Okay, Chair Hamilton, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 1020. Chair Hamilton, is the DE3 amendment yours?
It is, Mr. Chairman.
Okay,
yes.
So to get the bill shape the author like, I will move the H1020DE3 amendment discussion. Hearing none, all fair say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much. Okay, we now have 1020 as amended. 2-year bill, Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. This bill creates a refundable workforce housing tax credit. And, Mr. Chairman, what I would like to do at this time is I'd like to turn it over to our testifier here to speak to the need of the bill, and then I also have Mr. Dorman here, too, to where we can take any policy or technical questions along with that.
Who's the guy to your left there? Who is that?
Does he look familiar, Mr. Chairman?
He sure does.
Right?
Please state your name and who works for the director, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Craig Clark, City Administrator for the City of Austin.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Home of the mighty Packers.
Go Packers. Mr. Chair, members, I appreciate the opportunity to be here in support of my former state rep, Rod Hamilton, and his efforts to help greater Minnesota cities who are looking to bring more resources to the table to solve a chronic problem with market rate housing in communities like Austin, Worthington, Thief River Falls, and many other rural communities across the state. We recently adopted a rental housing registration, and I looked over that list and surprisingly to find that we haven't had a market rate unit in over 45 years built in Austin. I think by definition that proves that the market's broken and we need some extra resources to help address the problem. Having a lack of market rate units prevents the natural process of individuals moving up the housing ladder to market rate rentals and eventually single family homes. We've seen a stagnation in population and a growth in cities for employers who are also looking to add jobs. I can tell you unequivocally for Austin, housing supply is our largest economic development issue for the city. This housing crisis is kind of an interesting scenario with housing in a community. You know, year by year, the housing stock in many rural communities is aging and deteriorating. And our council agendas, we've commonly seen almost every agenda instances where we have nuisance actions by the city council to address blight and hazardous structures in the community, and this is just further proof to the challenging housing crisis. Austin's not set by idly. We're not here asking for just the state to partner with us only. We've done so on the local level in a dramatic fashion. We formed an ad hoc committee on housing, and I've included in your packet, and you should have at your table, a flyer that we put together that the city, county, and school district banded together to form a tax abatement program, a 5-year tax abatement for any new multifamily or single-family homes to try to spur the housing supply issue. We've also worked with MHFA. We have a federal housing tax credit project moving forward, so we're trying to bring all resources to the table where possible. We had a 2013 housing study that outlined the demand and need in housing for Austin. When we look at the calculation on prevailing rents and what would be necessary to finance these and fund the gap from a local perspective, we're looking at millions of dollars from the local government to help finance those and get market rate units both in our communities. So the challenge is significant. We'd really appreciate having more resources from the state and ask that you support House File 1020 to help us tackle these challenges and move forward a more collaborative effort with state and local governments to try to address this housing challenge in our communities.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Is Mr. Dorman a resource? We'd like to go on the record here. Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Chair Davids. My name is Dan Dorman, the Executive Director of the Greater Minnesota Partnership.
Greater Minnesota Partnership has worked on this issue extensively over the last couple of years. I thought last year was going to be a good year for us. We'd snuck into the Senate tax bill and just didn't quite get it across the goal line. We hope to this year because workforce housing is a increasingly important issue in Greater Minnesota when it comes to growth. It's not that the jobs aren't there. In many cases, they are. There's just no place for them to live. I know, Mr. Chair, you had a tight schedule, so we didn't want to drag everybody in front of you, but I know the mayor of Thiever Falls also in the room, and we chatted before this. They've got an exciting expansion potential up there, but it's going to be dependent, again, on where these people are going to live. I hear that from our 90 members that travel throughout Greater Minnesota, darn near every part of the state, about the need for market-rate housing. The existing programs aren't working very well for us, and we think Representative Hamilton's approach will very much go a long way to help get these jobs filled and return Greater Minnesota maybe to more of an economic prominence.
Well, I think we should bring the mayor down. You said the mayor of Thief River Falls. Why don't you come on down and make a few comments? We do have a lot of bills left here, but you drove quite a ways. On the remaining bills, while the gentleman's coming down, are there on the remaining bills, are there folks that have driven more than 50 miles to testify? Okay, on this bill, House File 1020 is amended. Anyone else from the audience like to testify with concerns in the department? Certainly can tell the committee what they're thinking on this bill anytime they'd like. Please state your name and who represents Thief River Falls. Crawlers?
That'd be one of them.
Go Crawlers, that's what I say.
For the record, my name is Brian Hummer, mayor of Thief River Falls, and thanks for hearing my testimony. Thief River Falls, we have more jobs than we do population. And it's a struggle for workforce housing. A lot of bills are out there that help, but the only thing that I'm here is to support this bill because it'll provide another resource for us to utilize. So, just like I say, I strongly support your effort on this one.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm from the southern part of Minnesota as well, and talking with the construction folks and others over there, one of the challenges has been in the fact that we don't have very many new starts, and they don't get new starts because they can't get the loan approved in the bank, and it's part of this may help. Their concern is that the homes that were built before the real estate crash are coming onto market with lower comparative rates or values than what the same house could be built today. So when appraisers come in for the mortgage and to do an appraisal on the property, it comes in higher than, the appraisal comes in lower than what it actually costs to produce it, mm-hmm. because that's what the comparative sales are. Mm-hmm. And so that's another challenge. Will this bill help in that regard, or is this just really just to kind of help keep the price down a little bit?
Mr. Homer or Mr. Dan Dorman?
Mr. Dorman? Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg, the bill will eventually help. This is about rental housing because most of our communities haven't seen market-rate rental housing constructed. Albert Lea is where I live, and we're in very similar shape to Austin. And that will eventually lead to single-family. We believe that will lead to more single-family ownership. What you see now is, I think of like AGCO and Jackson. They've got so many of their employees driving 30, 40 miles away to get there, that it's starting to limit their ability to grow because they have other plants. And so their concern is, we'd love to grow in Minnesota, but we need Jackson to grow first. And so if these communities don't grow, that's the single-family market will never really take off. It's a weird conundrum because there are good-paying jobs that are there. The market just hasn't responded with rental units and enough supply to fill these jobs.
Representative Petersburg?
Thank you. I had assumed that this was also for single-family homes as well, but if it's just for us, I understand the process. Maybe we can work on the other one, too, because we need single-family units out there as well. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much.
Representative Lomer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thanks for bringing this forward, Representative Hamilton. And this is crucial for rural economic development. There's, just as the mayor said, there's more jobs than residents, and there's a number of cities out in rural Minnesota. That's the case, and employers are, they can't get people there because there's no housing, or they have to bus them in and so forth, and it creates problems. And Representative Petersburg, you're exactly right. I mean, out in rural Minnesota, just the building materials and everything to build a building, once it's done, you're not going to be able to sell it for that. So there needs to be some of this kind of gap financing, if you will. So I think this is one tool in the toolbox that can be used. So thank you, Representative Hamilton, for bringing this forward with this. Housing is, it's a huge issue out there. So thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I always like to see us targeting our efforts because there's so much demand for workplace housing throughout the state and affordable housing throughout the state that there's just no way I don't think we can afford to help every area that's got a housing problem. And so I was really interested in your workforce housing undersupply ratio on line 2.21, which is you divide the full-time jobs by the number of persons over 16 area, you know, living in that area. But then you look at the area, and it's located at an eligible project site under line 2.17. And the project site could be, you know, three square blocks. It could be, it doesn't really define a big area. And to me, the key would be to really prove that there is a shortage in that area. Then it's not just the home city wants everyone to live within the city's borders when there is plenty of housing in the surrounding townships and cities. And, you know, my community probably has more jobs than housing, too, and I sure wish that all those people who make the big salaries and live in perhaps Representative Applebaum's districts, a few more of those lived in Minneapolis. Instead, we tend to have the people who are needing the affordable housing clustered in my neighborhoods. And so housing's a challenge all of us are wrestling with. But I'm wondering if the advocates of this bill would be open to better defining that, like within a reasonable commuting distance, which you could define as 35 minutes or less of travel time. Most of my residents, quite honestly, spend more than that time on the bus, those that are bus dependent. But we do have people who drive in an hour and a half to get into our community, and, you know, people define their own tolerance for being in commute. But I think if you had a reasonable commuting distance, that might help better define the need, because I'm sure there's going to be huge demand for this if we pass it, and how can we target it to the communities that really need it?
Okay, members, just to let you know, we do have a number of bills, and we want to get through them before the adjournment, unless you want to come back at 6 o'clock tonight. I know HHS has a number of bills that we have to, and there's some members here. So just to put that out there before we have the testifiers or Representative Hamilton answer the question of Representative Loeffler. Mr. Dorman.
Mr. Chair and Loeffler, I would direct you to lines 1.18 to 1.22. That is, it speaks of market rate vacancies, and that language is very similar to that is in the DEED Workforce Housing Grant Program that I think was started 3 years ago. So that's an attempt to get at what you're driving at is how to target it. But if you have or others have suggestions to improve that, the point is valid, but it is somewhat addressed in there that you have to have at least a 4% or less a vacancy rate. So that is sort of what we're trying to drive at, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Dorman. Representative Loeffler.
And just briefly, that starts, but two of the last 5 years is a pretty big window, and and I think 15 miles is still a pretty tight circle. So I just asked the author to think about some other options as we move forward. Thank you.
Representative Applebaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the idea behind this bill is workforce housing, but it seems to me after reading it that it only applies to market rate housing, and I guess I'm confused on why you would exclude, if you look at lines 1.23, market rate residential properties, the definition, it excludes properties with line 2.1 financial assistance requiring property to be occupied by residents that meet income limits under state and federal law. And what that provision does is allow developers to leverage state and federal dollars and also help people actually afford their housing. And so I'm curious if you would be willing to expand this and make it subject to true affordable housing too. So
workers can actually afford where they're living, as opposed to solely market rate housing, which to me is kind of at odds with the whole workforce housing concept.
Who would like to handle that, Mr. Dorman?
Mr. Clark, Craig with the City of Austin. What we're seeing here is we're targeting a group that has incomes large enough to be able to pay for the market rate units and address the market shortcomings to produce them in greater Minnesota. Those that have higher incomes and that can afford truly market rate rentals, we're not looking to try to subsidize those individuals. So there's still a gap between the cost of that producing the housing for that income threshold that still can falls off the affordable side and going into more higher income housing, but not full market rate.
Representative Applebaum?
That's fine. I'll talk after. I know we have a lot of bills to say.
Okay, thank you. Representative Applebaum?
Well, I just think people should think about the math on this. You know, if you look at what we're talking about in 18, we're talking about a $5 million appropriation. We're saying the maximum investment is $1 million in a project. It costs probably at least $100,000 a unit to build a fairly basic apartment building these days. You know, a lot of your basic apartment buildings are 24-unit buildings. So let's say you build a apartment building for $2.5 million, you'd get at $100,000 a unit about a 24-unit apartment building. So at $5 million a year, you'd get five apartment buildings across the entire state of Minnesota. And so this isn't going to, as it is, do a whole lot for the workforce housing crisis around the state. Now, I'm not suggesting that we should spend $500 million or anything, but I think people should just understand that this, as it is really not going to do that much for the whole workforce housing crisis. And I'm not speaking against the bill, but I would suggest we should also be looking at things like, I don't know where manufactured housing enters into this. I don't know where maybe some of the codes that drive up the cost of building housing in greater Minnesota enter into this, but I think those are factors that are causing issues with construction too.
Okay, very good.
That's just a comment.
Thank you, Representative Knobloch, for your input. Representative Hamilton, do you have any thoughts to that? Otherwise, is there anyone else from the audience who would like to speak on behalf of the bill? Members, any other questions? Representative Hamilton, closing thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for the thoughtful discussion and debate, and I would humbly ask for your support.
Very good. Representative Hamilton, no, he doesn't. I'll have to renew my motion. Who motioned this one in the first place?
David.
Oh, Representative Davis will renew his motion, even though he's not here, for this bill to be laid over for possible inclusion of the omnibus bill. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
No, you don't have to vote. Don't even say aye.
Just keep your gavel.
So, gavel down. And with that, Representative Hamilton, you also have the next bill, House File 1088. I will move to... I move House File 1088 to be laid over for possible inclusions. Representative Hamilton, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This bill provides a refundable income tax credit of up to $7,000 to offset the cost of making a residence accessible for peoples with disabilities. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would turn it over, in essence of time, I'll turn it over to my testifier who can walk us through the bill. Do we have an amendment?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, we do have an amendment. All right, if I could get someone to move the A1 amendment.
Representative Garofalo moves the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. To the testifier, if you would state your name and who you're with for the record, and you may begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Andreessen. I'm with Senior Manager of Advocacy for the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, here testifying in support of House File 1088. Almost all of us at some point of our lives will experience a disability, whether the result of a chronic disease, illness, developmental disability, accident, or age. When living with a condition which limits mobility, the functionality of a home can be the difference between living in that home or having to leave it for long-term nursing care. Without proper equipment and modifications, a home can be a dangerous place for someone with limited mobility. In order to remain safe at home, modifications such as installing ramps, grab bars, lifts, widening hallways, or full room remodels is often a necessity. Unfortunately, these accessibility modifications can be quite costly, ranging from anywhere from $100 to tens of thousands of dollars. Making these modifications can be a costly burden for a population that already faces financial challenges regarding increased health care costs, pharmaceutical and rehabilitation costs. And so House Bill 1088 can help Minnesota seniors and Minnesotans living with disabilities maintain their independence by providing this modest tax credit when modifying a home to increase accessibility and safety. Continuing to live in one's home promotes emotional well-being, independence, and maintaining connection to community, as well as being a cost-effective way for living. If we can keep 25 people in our homes for a year out of long-term care, that's $1 million of cost avoidance. The bill is targeted for Minnesotans who are living over the age of 65 or living with a disability. For up to $7,000 tax credit, the A1 amendment puts a income eligibility cap at at 500% of poverty, and then there's a small phase out once that that is reached. It also changes the credit to be non-refundable, which looking at the Department of Revenue's revenue note may change the numbers on that note.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Questions for the testifier? Representative Hirtos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just noticed on line 1.13, is there any particular reason you're limiting this help to anybody who is 65 or older if they're disabled or have a physical limitation? Would you not want to provide that for anybody who's trying to live independently?
Representative Hamilton or Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if we need to fix that, it should be for anyone over the age of 65 or living with a disability. So if that's unclear.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton?
Mr. Chairman, it starts on lines 1.12, the qualified person has a disability, or, and then it goes into a qualified person is 65 years of age or older.
You got to read the whole bill, I suppose. Very good. Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Representative Hirtos?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that answers my question.
And Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members of the committee, I was looking at the fiscal note, and maybe a testifier can talk to this as well. This is meant for homeowners, and in the fiscal note it included rental homes as well, and that was not the intent of the legislation, but I'll let the testifier speak to that.
Mr. Anderson or staff? Ms. Dalton, should we address that? Or no, she's not here. Okay. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hamilton. I think this is a good idea. I'm usually not the biggest fan of tax credits all in all. I think we can do a lot better having actual programs out there, but I do think that this hits a segment of the population here in Minnesota and provides an opportunity for people to stay at home. That's why I signed on the bill originally with you and have quite a few neighbors that I've seen go through this process in our rural aging community. And it gets expensive, so I think it's a good temporary solution to this and look forward to hopefully seeing it make it into the final tax bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. That's a question, Mr. Representative Hamilton. Is this just for existing homes, not for any new homes that would be constructed for a person that has a disability or is 65 years or older with a disability? Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking for it on here. It is for existing and new construction.
Huh.
apologize, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Anderson, I guess as I read the bill as well, it says just qualified for modification or improvements.
For existing.
For existing. Sorry. That answers my questions. I'll read the bill. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I certainly have no argument with the intent of the bill, but I'm as Mr. Andreessen, I think, knows, I'm still uncertain about this as a tax credit because it strikes me it should be a property tax program. It's about making changes to real property. Many of the changes, not all obviously, would be permanent. Wider doorways, adapted bathroom facilities, things like that, that would impact the value of the home and with the aging baby boomers, possibly make the home more advantageous on the market. So I'm still hung up in my head with this idea that this is a great idea for a property tax program. Do either Mr. Andreessen or the author want to comment?
Mr. Andreessen? Mr. Chair, Representative, we're kind of following the models that other states have used in the past. There have been several states that have used income tax credit for these type of modifications, and it's worked well in those states, and so that was the reason we went down this path. Virginia's had one in place for 10 years. It's been very successful, and so that's kind of why we went down the income path.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. Line 2.24, you define a qualified person. So it includes, like, if you have an elderly parent living with you, you would qualify for that. And the qualified person wouldn't have to be 65 years and older, just that you're... Okay, got you. Thank you. Thank you.
Very good. Members, any other questions? Representative Domblock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hamilton, on the handout that is here from the MS Society, it says that there's an income qualification that you have to have an income under 500% of the federal poverty guideline. But I don't know if I've been able to find that in your bill. Is there a income qualification in the bill, and is it 500%? And if so, why that number? That seems pretty high compared to a lot of other means-tested programs we have.
Representative Knobloch, that was an amendment that Representative
Hamilton... That was put on. Okay.
The A1 amendment that Representative Groffner...
Yes, the A1.
Okay, I'm sorry. So then if I can ask Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, why 500%? That seems pretty high compared to a lot of the other means-tested programs we have in the state.
Fair enough.
Mr. Chair, Representative...
Mr. Anderson. Andreessen.
We kind of chose that as kind of a middle ground, so a lot of states handle this differently. Virginia does not have an income requirement. State of Kansas has 450%. And so we chose 500 as kind of a middle ground, recognizing that we need to have some type of limit. I think some folks will say that is high. I would say that if you're living with a disability or a chronic disease such as MS, a lot of your income goes away in terms of health care and other costs. So even though that may seem like a high income, there's a lot of other out-of-pocket costs that would make you eligible for that.
Representative Butler?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess it still seems like a high number. I mean, that would mean a family of four would have an income of, I think, $125,000 a year or something like that. Now, probably not too many of these people are going to have a family of four, but if they have MS, they probably have a lot lower income than that, too. It just seems like a high income to me, but I'll leave it at that.
Very good. Any other questions for members? Anyone in the audience wants to speak on behalf of the bill? If not, Representative Hamilton, any closing thoughts?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, once again, thank you for the thoughtful discussion, and I'd ask for your support.
Very good. Representative McDonald renews his motion for House File 1088 to delay as amended, to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All right, thank you.
We'll bring back my better half.
You're better 1.66, right?
Okay,
I will move House File 1303. Thank you for your patience, Representative Albright. Senator, is the A1 amendment yours?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it is.
I will move the H1303A1 amendment. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have 1303 as amended before us. Representative Albright, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 1303 would establish a state-run new markets tax credit program in Minnesota based largely off the successful federal new markets program. The program's purpose is to encourage investors to make investments in low-income or distressed communities that lack access to capital. With me today is Julia Nelmark from the Midwest Section for the New Markets Program Coordinator, and I will turn over the rest of my time in the space of brevity for her comments and to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Albright. First of all, before we get to the witness, is there anyone that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill other than the witness at the table? Anyone with concerns? And, of course, the department can weigh in anytime they'd like. Okay, with that being said, to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Julia Nelmark from Midwest Minnesota Community Development Corporation in Detroit Lakes, or MMCDC, where I run our New Markets Finance Division. Of our $544 million in federal allocation, almost 70% of that has been used in rural Minnesota. This bill calls for a state new markets tax credit modeled after the federal program, which would provide a tool to reduce borrowing costs for businesses in areas lacking access to affordable capital. The tax credit equity would stay in the state with the businesses. The bill calls for a $300 million allocation over 3 years, which translates to tax expenditures totaling $117 million over 9 years, or an annual average of about $13 million. The government receives a return in the form of increased future tax revenue and decreased assistance costs. We had a similar program in last year's tax omnibus bill that passed the House and Senate. With new markets, we are able to work with most types of businesses to help them grow and create jobs. This has been rated as one of the top 25 most effective federal programs, and it is by far the best tool we have in the community development industry for business growth and job creation. New Markets is a public-private partnership. For each $1 of government subsidy, we bring in about $5 to $7 of private investment. There is a high demand for these credits, usually about 7 times at the federal level and similar here in Minnesota. By adding this state tax credit, we'll be able to focus on Minnesota, both metro area and greater Minnesota. This bill provides for the split to be half and half between the two. Minnesota has benefited from over $1 billion of federal new markets financing through 2014, which has helped create over 8,500 permanent jobs and over 12,000 construction jobs. However, Minnesota is not one of the underserved states targeted for the federal new markets program. By passing this bill, we'll be able to facilitate some 3,000 permanent jobs and roughly an equivalent number of construction jobs here in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for members? Okay, thank you very much for that. Representative Albright, any closing remarks?
No.
Okay, that's the right answer. The chair will renew the motion to House File 1303 as amended to be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much. Item next, Representative Hagan, 1952. I see that we have an amendment. Representative Grunhagen, is that yours?
Yes.
Okay, so Representative Grunhagen moves House File 1952. Representative Grunhagen moves the H1952A1 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have 1952 as amended. Okay, so with that, the two-year bill, briefly, Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for hearing this bill. What HF 1952 does, it addresses a tax credit, a non-refundable corporate and income tax credit to railroads that make safety improvements to priority crossings. The Minnesota Department of Transportation would be directed to establish a list of priority crossings by October 1, 2017, following the methods used in the mandated 2014 study. So the MDT has already done a 2014 study identifying the priority crossings. This would the tax credit would apply to Class 1, Class 2, and also short line railroads. With that, I have Mr. Appetz here representing the railroad industry to comment on the bill.
Was Mr. Appetz a resource, or did you have some statements you'd like to make?
Mr. Chairman, I'll speak to the bill just briefly, if I may.
Certainly.
Representative Grunhagen brought this bill forward and asked what we thought of it. And all I can say is this is a tremendous idea. It certainly is a refreshing alternative to the $100 million tax increase that the administration proposed for railroads in the last couple of years. So we appreciate that ever so much, especially we appreciate the fact that he has expanded this to include short line railroads at this point. As those originally written, we dealt with Class 1, large railroads, Class 2, medium-sized railroads. Now the short lines as well, and the reason why that's significant is the short line railroads are kind of like the Main Street shopkeepers of the railroad industry. They're the ones who do the retail enterprise work and work on a much thinner margin than the larger railroads that operate here in the state of Minnesota. So adding that in is very helpful. Also, this reflects in some ways an effort made by the Congress over the last several years to provide a tax credit to short lines for improvement of their infrastructure up and down their tracks. It was a 50% per mile up to $3,500, I believe, tax credit that short lines could take. So this kind of mirrors that. The state of Minnesota took a little while in recognizing that. Originally it was considered income to the short line, and so it diminished the value of that. The state now recognizes that tax credit, and this kind of takes us a bit further down that track. Very quickly, just understand, railroads are private businesses. They're not run by the government, and as such, they're responsible for improvements to their track and infrastructure. They're responsible for 100% of those costs, and they return about, when they put about 15 to 20% of the revenues they generate back into the infrastructure every year. So any dollar that's provided through a tax credit like this would very likely go back into the infrastructure and would be very helpful to resolving this. The study that Representative Grunhagen talks about is, or spoke of, is the one done by MnDOT, dealt with the crude oil routes coming out of North Dakota through Minnesota, and about 431 crossings along there that are involved. We spoke a little bit earlier and thought with the expansion to the short lines it may include some additional crossings, and we'll certainly take a look at that. We appreciate Representative Grunhagen bringing this forward, and want to thank you all for thinking about it.
Is there anyone in the audience like to testify on behalf of the bill or with concerns? Chair Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Grunhagen, this is a question I could have asked on a couple of the other bills, but I'll ask you, is that why a tax credit as opposed to maybe just creating a grant program with the state to cover these items?
Representative Grunhagen?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Graffel. A grant program generally has to go through the state government, and there's usually shrinkage of dollars. A tax credit goes direct to the company. Also, in crafting this bill, I wanted to thank Mr. Michaels for his input, and there is just a certain way that we can address this, according to Mr. Michaels, and so I relied on his expertise in crafting the bill.
For Mr. Michael.
Mr. Michael.
Correct. Chair Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Grunhagen, while it's correct that this is not public funds, can be viewed as credits and deductions can be viewed as spending, and it's just something I hope the committee is tracking is the a lot of credits this year that can be categorized as spending. Not a statement in favor or against the bill, Representative Grunhagen, but just a commentary. Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen?
Yeah, I think just a quick comment. We've seen some terrible accidents on railways, and I know last session there was a concern about addressing that. And I think historically when you provide tax credits tied directly to a particular action you'd like to see a business take, it focuses that business on getting those things completed. And with the amount of oil that transports through Minnesota and the danger it could be to communities, property, and life, I think this would highlight the need to get those updated and corrected. In addition, it's a 50% credit. I want the max credit. But Mr. Chair, there's lots of room for modification. You could target short lines with this. You could, based on your grace and discretion, you could modify this bill down to an acceptable level of the fiscal note that would hopefully fit into your omnibus tax bill.
Chair Grapple. Representative Metza, then Wills, and we need to wrap it up to get to the Loon bill. Representative Metza.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and I carried a light safety bill a few years ago, and I was just wondering, Mr. Aphitz, if this would qualify projects like that in order to have more worker safety for handling changing cars and making sure people can see while they're working when that's happening at night.
Mr. Appet.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Metz, I do recall that bill that was passed, and I believe this would deal more with crossings rather than yards. Your bill dealt with yards, as I recall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but this might free up other funds to cover some of those requests that we put on the railroad companies in another way, so to speak.
Mr. Appet.
Possibly so, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wills. Then we're going to go to the office to wrap it up. Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a similar question to Representative Garofalo. Why a tax credit as opposed to seeking bonding funds for railroad improvements? Is one better than the other?
Representative Grunhagen, briefly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wills, there's no interest on a tax credit.
Representative Wills. Okay, seeing no further questions from members, Representative Grunhagen renews the motion that House File 1952, as amended, be later passed through the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen and Mr. Appet. Item last, House File 1499. Chair Loon moves House File 1499. I see no amendments. Is there anyone wish to testify on behalf of the bill?
I do have two testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Okay, please come on down, and this is going to be like Jimmy John's freaky fast testimony. So, anyone else wish to speak on behalf of the bill with concerns? And the department, I believe, has a letter in our packet. No?
Yes.
Members, there's a letter regarding the Loon bill from Mr. Cummings, and so please refer to that. So, to your bill, Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1499, similar to a provision that was included, I believe, in last year's tax bill, and that I offered last year, last session, would increase Minnesota's dependent care credit and would model it more on the amount applicable under the federal credit, but our state credit is refundable, which the federal is not. And so right now, for families with dependent care needs, when your household income is over $25,860, that credit begins to phase out. So families with an annual income of $39,510 or over receive no credit on our state level for their dependent care. With Minnesota being the third highest of all 50 states, as according to the Economic Policy Institute, for the cost of child care, we really need to do something to help families that deal with these costs. Some of the figures I were able to pull is that the average cost of infant care in Minnesota is over $14,000 a year, and that is higher or more expensive than the annual cost of a four-year public college in Minnesota. And with our median household income in the state of $67,244, if you had two children in daycare or child care, an infant and a slightly older child, it would cost you about over $25,000, and that's about 38% of your median household income. So we very much need to help, I would say, lower and middle income families definitely with the cost of these expenses, and that is what the bill proposes to do. So I would begin the phase out at income levels of $70,000 for the dependent care credit.
And thank you, Chairman, for that. And members, if you do read the letter, it looks like the governor, the administration, Governor Dayton, Lieutenant Governor Smith, and the department are favorable to the concept, but as they say, they're a little differently, so they look forward to working with us on that. So please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Joe Paquette. I'm an owner-operator of two child care centers. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Child Care Association.
Welcome, Minister.
Thank you. And as a representative for the families that attend my centers, this is a credit that I think is truly needed by the families. Just to give you a couple of statistics about my families, their household incomes are between about $40,000 and $95,000 between my two centers. These are well above the current threshold of the law. Child care is one of their biggest expenses. They're paying probably $10,000 to $15,000 a year for one child, even more than that for infants. That represents about 10% to 15% of their household incomes. So this is a big expense that they have to incur, and any type of relief that we can provide them will allow them to keep up continuity of care so that they can keep their children in child care. Some of them are right on a fine line. A loss of a job or loss of income could mean pulling children out, which is helpful to the children or for the families. So I'm here to urge you to support the bill and to pass this for the sake of our families in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Pickett. Please state your name and who you represent, Director, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Nan Madden. I'm Director of the Minnesota Budget Project and also testifying today on behalf of the Kids Can't Wait Coalition. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you've heard a lot of bills this morning aimed at economic development, and this bill really is aimed at the labor supply part of the equation. With a tightening labor market and worker shortages in some industries and parts of the state, we can't afford to have good workers on the sidelines because they can't afford the cost of child care. I want to really thank Representative Loon for her commitment and leadership on this issue over the years. This bill would benefit nearly 67,000 Minnesota families and really make the difference for families struggling to afford care. So we urge your support for this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Madden. Questions for members for Ms. Madden, Mr. Pickett, or the author? Chair Knobloch.
Just one real quick question, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pickett or Ms. Madden, you know, we've got, I guess, a subsidized child care program where we have appropriations in the Health and Human Services area. How does something like this interact with that? I guess, where does that limit cut off, and how much do people that qualify for that get?
Ms. Madden?
Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch, we think of this as working kind of on a spectrum with the basic sliding fee, child care assistance. We think that's the best mechanism for our lowest income families. This credit tends to go to families with slightly higher incomes but still quite modest and struggling, and the credit only applies to their out-of-pocket costs. So a family that might be getting assistance from basic sliding fee, if this is your question, to the extent they had out-of-pocket costs, those would apply towards the credit, but certainly not the portion of their care that was subsidized by the state, only what was paid directly by the families.
Chairman Knobloch?
In the interest of time, I'll pass.
Chair Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pickett, my question for you is, outside of staffing costs, what's your biggest cost driver for providing care, in particular in the metro area for care providers? Is it government that is the big cost driver for you, or what raises your prices?
Yeah. Behind staffing, my largest cost will be government regulation and taxation. I mean, especially the property taxes I pay are pretty steep, as well as the different regulations that we have to follow. There's plenty of opportunity there to try to curtail some of the operating costs that we face.
And just quickly, Mr. Chair, Mr. Pickett, would you say that Minnesota is an outlier when it comes to the regulations and when you compare us to the rest of the nation?
Mr. Pickett?
I'm a owner-operator of a franchise child care, so I do have some knowledge of what other states are doing, and Minnesota typically is the toughest, most regulated state of the ones that I'm familiar with.
Chair Anderson has. Questions for members? Chair Carlson?
Yeah, just maybe a quick response. Are those regulations the ratios that drive the cost? Because I know that Minnesota has some pretty strict ratios relative to infants, a very small ratio, and it gets larger as the child gets older, but is that the big cost driver?
Mr. Paquette?
Representative Paulson, that is correct. The ratios are probably lower here in Minnesota than you're going to find in other states, although we do in Minnesota reach best practices with those ratio levels.
Chair Carl.
And Mr. Chairman, I remember years ago being involved with the hearing, and I forget all the detail of it, but when you get involved with ratios, then, of course, there's the public safety component of that in terms of the number of children that an adult is responsible for. And I'm far from an expert on that, but I know we have to adjourn. But just a quick comment. The largest pay increase I ever received in my life, I told somebody this morning.
Was July 1st?
It wasn't July 1st. That doesn't hold a candle. It was when my youngest son was now 40, and it was a lot cheaper relative to, you know, there's been inflation. But when he started school, it was no longer in child care. And I joked that that was the biggest bump that we ever got.
Questions for members? Okay, with that, Chair Loon renews her motion that House File 1499 be there for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Members, anything else for the good of the order? Thank you, members, for your work today and every day. Good job all the time. We're here.